live from the NBC News Radio broadcasting studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful, sunny California. Welcome, everybody, to the Water Zone Show today. Great Thursday. I'm here with one of my best buddies and the great co-host of the show, Mr. Chris Davey. How are you doing today?
Great. Good evening to you, Robert. I'm doing great. I'm just here to go with the flow, man. So, you know, doing a show called...
I thought you were here for the beer. Let's get real.
No, that was last week. Go with the flow, which for a show called The Water Zone gives new meaning to that saying.
That's right. And you know what they say?
Bup.
We can do the bubbles like... what was his name? The band leader. It's a one. It's a two. It's a...
Oh, that, yeah.
Do you remember that? Lawrence Welk. See?
Even
our engineer Nick knew that.
He knew that. Look at that. He's bouncing his head in there and going, I knew that. Where's my latte?
Yeah, that's true. So we're recovering from the Irrigation Association show and conference last week. That was great. Had a lot of good people.
Awesome to be there. Sunny Southern California in Long Beach where it rained all 3 days.
Oh, it was pouring. Did you see the leaks in the roof?
Yeah, I did, in the back there, yeah.
Luckily, our booth didn't get drenched. But,
yeah, we had buckets ready, though, just in case.
Buckets ready. We had lots of interviews, got a lot of good people. Yep. I had a lot of our sponsors come by, which I really appreciate, and we thank them very, very much for entrusting us with carrying on water information. Yep. But the good part about it is somebody who also helps us, Miss Chris Austin from Maven's Notebook. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
We doing fine.
You out partying at the irrigation conference, huh?
if you call it that, sure.
Yeah, yeah, we attended a couple parties, but they were sort of, they were good. I didn't particularly care for the music that they
had. Yes. What was that? Techno drive or something?
I don't know, but it wouldn't stop going boom, boom,
goodness,
boom. And you couldn't talk to anybody, and it was just loud.
Yeah. You know that thing in Jurassic Park where the Tyrannosaurus Rex stands down and the rings in the water like rocks in a pond, right? No, my beer was doing that, just holding it like this. Wow.
But it was good. We saw lots of people. I think it was a good show. They did a lot of good... A lot of good training there. And everything else, and we had a lot of people come by the booth, and we did a lot of recordings. Had almost 8 hours worth of recordings.
Wow.
Over the 2 days, which we will be playing over the next couple of weeks.
On future shows.
Yeah, very interesting people, people from Weldon, people from Micrometer. So it covered both the irrigation, both for residential, commercial, as well as ag.
Yeah,
and we had some people who were into soils. We had the gentleman Jim Clouser won the special award from the IA.
Right,
he was there, and we interviewed him. We were the first person to interview him. No, I guess we were the second. They talked to him on stage.
Yeah, yeah. We also had various associations there that we interviewed, including the Green Industry Hall of Fame.
Right, we had Lawn and Landscape Magazine and. People from the IA. It was a great show.
Yeah, and for those listeners who were at the show and saw us, appreciate you coming by and waving or giving us a thumbs up. As many of you know, we had the recording studio actually on the show floor in the booth. Toro booth. So that was kind of fun.
Looked good. So I understand our wonderful state senator, Ms. Dianne Feinstein, Mrs., is pushes to extend controversial water law despite environmental concerns.
Well, yeah, Feinstein made a deal with McCarthy, which is unusual because, you know, Feinstein's a Democrat, McCarthy is a Republican.
Yep.
And they made this deal to extend the provisions of the WIN Act, which is Water Infrastructure Improvement for the Nation Act. It was a law that got passed, the last December Obama was in office, and it was pretty controversial. Kind of loosened up some of the restrictions on pumping in the Delta and some other environmental things that that a lot of people weren't happy with, and they just weren't happy with the feds, you know, getting involved in state business anyway. But there was definitely some controversial things, and those provisions were set to expire, but Feinstein and McCarthy got together and worked out a deal. So it's attached to the spending bill as a rider, is my understanding.
But
it may not happen.
But isn't it good that two people can sit down and at least give a little on each side and come up with something?
Yeah, you know, but these are some very controversial provisions, and in this type of lawmaking, the public never got a chance to weigh in. They just kind of did this back there, you know, the GOP senators, or not, I'm sorry, GOP congressmen, kind of came up with this deal, and even the initial WIN Act. It's part of the process, I think, at least in California water, to, you know, let the stakeholders weigh in, because things affect people, and you need to understand what those effects are.
Totally agree. My whole thing is there's always going to be dissent between parties on what they do, but I'll give them credit, more than a little bit, that at least they can sit down and talk about it and do something instead of just argue no on each side and don't move forward. That's just me.
Yeah. For summary.
But, you know, this is where people are really wanting to get more scientists involved with the decision-making, because these types of decisions that these, you know, legislators make back in D.C. have impact to people on the ground, to the species, to the environment. And, for things going on at, say, the Delta Stewardship Council, or things that happen inside the state, you know, we examine the environmental effects, and there's a public process. But when people back in Washington make these decisions, you know, there can be unintended consequences. And really, you know, we would want scientists to weigh in on something that could mean the extinction of salmon or something. So, you know, I mean, it's great that there's actually in these years, you know, there's a bipartisan kind of sort of solution, but it's one where the public was left out.
No,
I agree. Controversial.
Overall, I agree with that statement. But, you know, it's just like people saying, or scientists saying, we believe in climate change. Then you have another group of scientists that says that's not true. They don't believe in climate change. So you can go on and on and on forever. It's just somebody making a decision and moving forward. Unfortunately, we're never going to have 100% of everybody agreeing with everything. It's just not going to happen.
No, but, you know, this is where, because these types of decisions that the legislators make back in Washington, D.C. have effects to species and you know, people, you know, there's really been a drive to get more science involved in policy making, and that needs to continue. And, you know, there are some things that are disputed and other things that are not. But, hey, speaking of disputed, the big thing that happened, though, I think that happened at the beginning of the week, I think, because it's been a busy week.
Right.
Or maybe that was last week. or the end of last week.
But you're going to talk about the water grab?
Yeah, but yesterday, the State Water Board really got down to it on the flow objectives for the San Joaquin River tributaries. Very controversial thing that they've been working on for a number of years now. And they've had a hearing, and they postponed it last month. Governor Brown and
it was supposed Governor to be on the Newsom. They postponed it till the 12th, I think.
Yeah, they sent a letter to the State Water Board and asked them to wait 30 days. So now those 30 days were up yesterday, and so the State Water Board went on and the bottom line is they voted to 4-1. To enact these flow objectives, but the state and some other of the water districts on those rivers had come forward and said, well, we have a voluntary agreement, kind of, sort of, but we haven't hammered out the details. And so the Water Board has tried to leave it open for further negotiations on that voluntary agreement, but they did vote to enact those those flow objectives. And then today, the commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation, Brenda Berman, released a statement that says they're very disappointed in that the state water board took the vote. They disagree. And although she didn't say it, it's widely suspected that there's going to be a lot of friction between the feds and the state on this, and that the feds may just decide we're not going to abide by your state water quality control objectives. So
I know that I was told by you know Jack, who works over the USBR. He's setting up a thing with Ms. Berman to be on our show.
So
maybe we can do that and have you as part of the interviewee with her.
Oh yeah, that would be fun.
That would be great.
Yeah, it's gonna be a big deal. There's definitely gonna be a clash here between the state, the state water board, the regulators, and the feds. And generally, the feds are supposed to abide by the state's water quality control standards, but there's going to be some litigation, it looks likely. Although the Department of Water Resources and the Bureau of Reclamation did come to some agreement on what's called the Coordinated Operations Agreement for the state and federal water projects, you know, how they work together to move water in the Delta. But that was just announced literally, like, 5 minutes before the show went on, so I just sent it out to everybody, but I haven't had a chance to look at the actual agreement, so I don't know what exactly they've agreed to. But they've reached agreement on that, so there's good news and there's bad news.
Yeah. Well, that'll be great reading for you tonight, Chris.
Oh yeah.
Well, on the subject and talking about regulators and investigations and things like that, I guess the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, right, have found some issues with the latest review they did on Oroville Dam safety.
Yeah, they keep looking at that, you know, and digging into that. It must be challenging to be a state agency and try and figure out what to do in an unprecedented situation. And, you know, looking back, it's easy hindsight 2020 vision, you know, but when you're going forward and you're having to deal with something that you've never had to deal with before, you're going to make mistakes. And you do need to go back and take a look at these things and figure out what to do so that, you know, that if it does happen again, you have, you know, or something similar, you have, you know, a better knowledge and a path forward. But,
right.
You know.
That's a difficult task for those guys. There's, there's no doubt about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it must have been something to be the point man when that spillway was chewing up. And, you know, I mean, there was a time, there was a point when the water was going over the emergency spillway because they were trying not to use the damaged spillway. And then because the emergency spillway, they never thought they would ever use it. It was pretty much just like a concrete lip on the top of the hill. And so that water started flowing down and started eroding out the hillside bad and cutting back towards the reservoir. So they had to make the decision to use the damaged spillway, and they didn't know what was going to happen.
Right.
I mean, can you imagine being in that position? But you couldn't have the hillside fail where that emergency spillway was. Then, I mean, that's why they evacuated everybody.
Yeah.
Was the fear of that. But, I mean, I would not have wanted to be that the guy in the hot seat that had to make that decision, you know.
Right, yeah.
And you must have, you know, just sat there at the edge of the seat, and it was at nighttime, and they couldn't see what was going on. They had no monitors. You know, they could fly drones over, but it's at night. You can't see what's going on.
Right.
So, they had to wait until morning to see, you know, what was going to happen. But must have been scarier. Like, you know, I'm glad I wasn't in that position.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to be that the person in that spotlight.
Oh, no, no. You know, if you have a major engineering failure, it's like, you know, Mulholland that built the
aqueduct, the California aqueduct, yeah.
Yeah, no, the Los Angeles aqueduct,
yeah.
Not the California one, but the one that comes down from Owens Valley.
Yes, on Eastern Sierra.
Yeah, it's an engineering marvel, you know, from built that in 1913. It's amazing what they did with no computers, just slide rules.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yep, and he got shot at in the process.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, but he built that system, but then he also built the dam in, San Francisco Canyon. And that dam failed
and
it washed, like 400 or 500 people died.
Catastrophically failed, yeah.
Yeah, and he never recovered from that. I mean, how could you, you know, to deal with that? You know, he built this engineering marvel, but he also had this tragic, horrific failure at the end.
Hey, so Chris, do you care to comment at all on what we've read in the news this week about all this reworking of the clean water protections that Mr. Trump is saying, hey, I'm going to come out, we're going to unveil some, you know, a lot of reworking and changes for that. You know, what's at the core of that issue?
Well, the Obama administration put out a rule on the Clean Water Act that brought a lot more, broadened the definition of waters that would be subject to the Clean Water Act. And one of them that's really controversial always is wetlands. You know, what's a wetland? And sometimes wetlands aren't wet all year. So, you know, when is it okay to plow up a dry piece of land that might be wet sometimes? You know, it's a difficult thing to define, and the rules were getting pretty strict because wetland habitat, you know, the whole country as a whole has lost a lot of wetland habitat. That's where, you know, migratory birds and fish, and, you know, we want these things on the planet. We got to have some wetlands around for that. But it was very controversial. A lot of people felt, you know, the definition was too broad, so, you know, it's part of the rollback, and it's a lot of waterways, you know, subject to the Clean Water Act will lose those protections. Now, how that's going to affect us here in California is unsure because we have the state Environmental Clean Water Act that's different than the Fed version. So we actually have stronger, stricter standards that the Feds have had to go by. But now here they're saying that in part is what the State Water Board is doing, is they're updating their plan, which is part of the Clean Water Act, the Federal Clean Water Act, and the state. It's the Porter Cologne Act, but it's the state version of the Clean Water Act. And so they're doing that, and now Reclamation is saying, well, we may not abide by your plan. We don't know.
Well, so would that be potentially dangerous for pesticide runoff and other pollutants?
Yeah, and basically it's going to make it easier for people to dump crap into the waterways or
exactly.
to plow up, you know, swamp or marshland. I mean, you know, a marshland essentially is a swamp, but we tend to think a swamp is useless. But, you know, swamp and wetlands are not, you know, they may not be the most scenic or beautiful of places, but they're habitat for birds and fish and all kinds of animals.
Sure, environmentally significant, yeah.
Yes, yes. And they clean the water that comes down from the land and before it flows into the ocean or other water bodies.
Natural filters?
Exactly. It's natural. So there's a lot of benefit to those wetlands. But sometimes people want to levy them off and build homes or estates or golf courses or whatever. And, you know, it would technically make it easier for people to do that.
Well, you got to balance the earth with all those things. I know Chris has got a burning question about reservoirs.
Oh, yeah. So I'm looking at the California reservoir map here, Chris. And, you know, certainly the season is off to a good start, a good wet start here in California. But looking at the reservoir maps, a lot of the northern California reservoirs are at 50% pool or less. Hopefully we get continuation of the weather pattern we've seen in mid-November through mid-December.
Oh, yeah, we're crossing our fingers. You know, we sometimes you can't really say. We have a nice wet fall, that's great, but we've had, you know, nice wet falls that turn into really dry Januaries and February.
You said it.
So, you know, we're going to hope that it keeps coming. You know, Oroville's down low because it was drawn down low for construction purposes. And so now that the spillway's finished, they'll allow that reservoir to fill again. So, yep. You know, in part, that's part of why that particular reservoir is low. And, you know, these other reservoirs, you know, we're hoping for the precipitation.
Well, it's supposed to rain here Sunday or Monday.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's, you know, that'll be
so
good.
So we'll hope for good rain that is just enough to refresh the landscape but not cause any nasty, gnarly mudslides.
Yeah, that was terrible.
Yep, you and us both.
Well, Chris, we appreciate you coming on again, and we're going to go from one smart lady to another in a minute here. And don't forget, anybody who really wants to know more about water than they ever want to know and be really up to date, the one person we go to is Chris Austin. She's the purveyor of Maven's Notebook. You go to www.mavensnotebook.com. And if you want to help support that as an ongoing thing and become a member and get these reports every single day, which is amazing. I don't know. You must stay up all night long to write these things. Well, I got him at his heart.
Oh, wait. Of course. Yeah, all night.
Well,
yeah.
You go. Well, I know you're gone all day to all these meetings. You're always sitting in the audiences of all these things with the State Water Resources Board, with Metropolitan Water, I mean, all over. And then you got to go home and write all this stuff.
A woman in the know.
That's absolutely. Yeah. So everybody, please check out mavensnotebook.com. It's a great place to go. And Chris, thank you very much.
Yep. Stand
all
by.
All right.
Good night, Chris. Have a good one. Stand by, everybody. We got a great guest coming up the second half of the show.
They don't have to stand. They can sit.
Yes. Or sit by. We got a guest from NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association.
Absolutely.
We'll be right back, guys.
So stick around. And ladies.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, K292 FQ Riverside, and K293 CF Moreno Valley.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Oh, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. Eco Series products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied, fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied, fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco Solvent Cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
Time to take a water break and talk some water. Irrigation. such a refreshing topic. As more and more markets face water restrictions, your customers may be hungry, or should I say thirsty, for water-saving products. For new installations, add options like drip irrigation, controllers that respond to weather data, pressure-regulating heads, or heads with check valves. They all provide easy ways to differentiate your bids and win more jobs. Or for an extra stream of revenue, offer existing customers upgrades like high-efficiency nozzles, rotary nozzles, or Wi-Fi-based controllers. Because when you help your customers save water, you make a world of difference for the earth and your bottom line at the same time. We'll drink to that.
Welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone Show with Chris and Rob. I hope everybody's doing well. And as I said a few minutes ago, this is the show of the smart women.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about Chris and me because we're not women. Maybe we should be. We'd probably be smarter. But anyway, we have a nice lady coming on. Her name is Dr. Amanda Sheffield, and she is the Regional Drought Information Coordinator at NOAA, which is the National Association of Atmospheric Association, and she does the Integrated Drought Information Systems.
That's right.
That was a mouthful. All these acronyms.
But anyway, FLAs. That's an FLA.
Anyway, we'd like to bring her on, and I just don't do well with all these acronyms. There's too many of them. Even in our business, we have ECOs and PRNs and PSNs and all this stuff. So, Amanda, welcome to the show, and thank you very, very much for agreeing to be on the show. We do appreciate that.
Oh, thank you for having me. And I agree that the federal government is full of acronyms and it's
mouthful. it's just amazing. It's amazing. My daughter, who's a lawyer in the FBI, told me about all the acronyms they have, and it's unbelievable.
Yes.
Every business has them, and you don't know what they are, and you mispronounce them because you say they're wrong. It's just like really reading license plates on cars.
Yeah.
And you try to figure
That's
out what they really say.
Yeah. So, Amanda, do you know what a TLA is? It's a three-letter
acronym. No, I do not.
It's a three-letter acronym.
Yeah, sometimes we call it the alphabet soup, but even at NOAA itself, how many acronyms we have and keep me to work on this type of work. And I sit down at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. It's down at UC San Diego. So that's sort of my academic home to work with this NOAA program. And it's great to be in that scientific community because they're doing great research on this work, too.
Yep. They certainly are. Yep. And you work on some pretty cool stuff. So tell us what NIDAS is, or our listeners what NIDAS is.
Yeah, definitely. So basically NIDAS was first authorized by Congress in 2006 by a public law. This was an interagency mandate basically to develop and provide a national drought early warning information system. So this means coordinating, integrating drought research and building upon great federal, tribal, state, and local partnerships. This followed basically after a decade of collaboration between the Western Governors Association, NOAA, and others to identify how to better prepare our nation for drought. And we sit under NOAA, but we do have a mandate to work with all the different types of agencies and academic communities that we work with. So basically, to break it down a little bit further, this national drought early warning system that we're working on, basically, we want to make sure folks have the right information at the right time before, during, and after drought. So this way, they can have a reduced impact and cost. And we were reauthorized in 2014 with bipartisan support because drought is a big issue. So we've been plugging away going forward with it since then. I'll mention a little bit after Chris comments that we're not a policy-making or policy-advocating group. We're more of an information source. So it's always great to hear what Chris was talking about because that gets outside of even what some of my knowledge base of what we're working on in drought in the state.
Wow. Hey, so I got a quick question for you. You said you work with a lot of you know, the federal, the regional, and tribal, and the other folks, as well as in the folks in the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
So we know who you work with, the constituents or the users of the information you provide. I mean, is it just everybody? Is it farmers? Is it government agencies? Is it can you tell us who the customer is, so to speak?
Yeah, we basically, the answer is all the above. So we do have certain pieces that I think are more geared towards the public outreach. Then we have more tailored information for those people on the ground actually making decisions and even farming and things like that. We have a bit of an audience with congressional members as well. So I think it's all the above in the sort of space of decision-making around drought or sort of wanting to stay aware of the information. The most forefront part of ourselves, which is probably the most front piece that people know about us, is drought.gov, which is the U.S. drought portal. We launched that in 2008 to be this information clearinghouse for the collection, integration, and communication of drought information. So this has data and models, forecasts and assessments, snapshots of the current drought conditions, resources for planning, all kinds of other documentation for reports from meetings and things like that. And so that's probably our most, you know, forefront piece of us. And the public use those. They especially like our state pages, so they can go and be like, hey, what's going on in my region right now? But then we do have our more advanced users. So because we work, since we were created by Congress, I think we have a responsibility right. for all types of users and customers.
I would think that the farming industry would be extremely interested in this. I had just seen a thing about living soil and agriculture, vertical agriculture growing straight up versus, you know, taking up tons of land. And they were saying in this video I watched that the soil, we don't take care of the soil very well, and with the drought conditions, that could really hurt the what they call living soil, and it needs to be, they need to monitor that very carefully, and we have to have a way to put nutrients back into the ground. Otherwise, we're never going to be able to produce enough food for everybody in the world. So I would think farming industry would be very interested in this, and isn't there some military usage for this thing as well?
I believe so. I haven't worked with those directly, but yeah, there's definitely uses between agriculture. Basically, our premise is this drought early warning system. So if they can get information early enough to prepare for drought or act on it once drought starts. So any industry that will work information like that. So water supply, land management, tourism, public health, agriculture, as you said, military, anything that affects the economy, they're all sort of these groups that we're working with and using. And we tailor information to what their gaps and needs and what they may be asking for, too.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you know, I guess you're always thinking about, really, everybody thinks about drought and and not having any water, but there are huger and much broader impacts to that, really, Amanda, than a lot of us think about, especially those ones that are economic, right? And billions of dollars in impact there. The best available information that you provide so the drought portal is really your landing mat, right? That's where everybody goes first?
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a place to grab that information, and it's embedded within there is all these other great information from other sources. So all our partners from those, you know, federal, state, local agencies, all their sort of information, you can go into there and start to discover it and figure out what's there, what can I use, and go even further beyond that to what other folks are providing there. So sort of, it's the portal's the right word. It's the launching point for going to see all these other tools. And we are going through a major update right now. We have some great new staff on the program that are great with Google Analytics and user information, and so they're doing a lot of testing and going to launch a new drought.gov next year that I think will have even better tailored information and be the home for all this different agencies' work.
What do they see as far as, if you had to look out 15, 20 years from now, just on your, because I'm sure you have modeling algorithms and all of these things behind all of this, what do you and your team think is going to be around in 15, 20 years in the world, and particularly here in the United States first?
Yeah, so that sort of gets into the planning and preparedness part of probably our work, and there's a section on the drought portal for that. There's a couple different federal agencies looking at that, how and providing that information. U.S. Bureau of Reclamation is one of them, who are doing these types of projections. And so they use global climate information as well as, you know, past trends and things to look forward. It's hard to, prediction and forecasting of drought is pretty hard to do, I think, as we heard on the short term from Chris, sure. but also on the long term. And so there are discussions about aridification. Are the dry areas going to keep getting drier? What areas used to be wet are starting to dry? So there are discussions in the scientific community, but it's really hard to pinpoint, even with the model projections, what exactly is going to be happening with precipitation. So a little trickier to do than, say, temperature and warming.
I know when I was a little kid in school, I'm older than you, Well, you're young. I mean, it's nice to be young. Wish I was still young. My brain thinks I'm young. My body tells me I'm different. But when you hear the words drought early warning system, I remember when I was a kid, probably Chris remembers this. Chris, do you remember the used to hear the sirens going? We had to go under our school desks mm-hmm. to protect ourselves. Is that what's going to happen with this thing?
Yeah, no, I often get that question because when they hear a warning system, they're like the weather service, like an earthquake alarm, mm-hmm. and it's not quite like that because drought, it's a slow hazard. You know, it takes time to develop. Depending what your concerns are, where you live, your impacts take a while to develop, and so it's not like an alarm bell or anything, but it's basically while the drought portal is just integrated information, I like to think of these drought early warning systems as the people side of it. So it's where this information is integrated into the people that are making decisions, that are providing the drought information, and this kinetic network basically that are prepared to provide information and act when we do have drought coming and after drought. So it's a little bit more of the on-the-ground folks that can make a difference with the drought planning. And we do them by regions. So, for example, I cover California and Nevada because they share common issues. They have unique challenges as well. But, for example, we share the Sierras. We share Colorado water. So I just work particularly with those two states to keep those groups networked together so they can act better during drought.
Right. I know the weather guys on TV and radio are getting better since I was a kid. Prediction, you know, they used to, you know, there always was the joke that if he says it's going to be sunshine, it's going to rain. If it rains, it's going to be nice. How is the accuracy today with all the new instrumentation and everything? It's got to be better than it was 10, 15, 20, 40 years ago. But how accurate are these things today?
Yeah, so that's a tricky question. Because, well, first you have to think about there's weather forecasting. So there's what you're forecasting in the next 2 weeks. And then there's more 2 months to a year to 2 years out, which is another in-between time frame before you get to some sort of climate prediction. And so while we've improved definitely by leaps and bounds on weather forecasting, this little in-between time period of a month, 3 months, 6 months, and further out still, it remains pretty elusive and tough. And part of that's just because of our dynamic earth system that we have. And this is actually a big priority for California and Nevada because we're in one of the hardest areas to forecast. The forecast scale isn't quite that high as some other areas part of the country. So, for example, even if like right now we're in an El Nino watch, that's the ocean conditions. We don't know exactly how the atmosphere is going to react to the ocean. And so I liked what Chris says. We've had nice falls, wet falls before, but then sometimes it doesn't, you know, stay wet throughout the entire year. And California and Nevada are especially tricky for that.
Yeah, especially here in Southern California as a skier, I look closely at that, Amanda, because, you know, if you don't get much local snow here in Southern California, you don't ski much. So,
And there's a lot of folks working on atmospheric rivers, if you've ever heard those.
Oh, yeah, things. Absolutely we have. We had a guest on and discussed that very issue, yeah.
Yeah, and so it, basically having 4 to 6 of those can make or break our season and whether we're going to have a wet year or whether we're going to have a dry year. And then thinking about the forecasting part, it's not just whether we have them, it's where they're going to hit our coast. Are they going to bring snow? Are they going to bring rain?
Yep.
So it's not even just identifying the event. Is it going to bring snow or rain, too, and versus flooding, too?
I know
they're too strong. It's not a good thing.
Well, I know the water agencies, you know, it's great that it's going to rain, but they got to make the plans to retain that water somehow, to capture it and get
capture
to
it, get store to it, transport it, mm-hmm. treat it.
That's really important.
Yeah, the changing in climate change also, Amanda, has a big influence on on the water storage capacity, especially here in the West, right? Because as it warms up and the snow level rises, mm-hmm. there's a different exchange between how much water is available at what time of year, right? If it's colder, then that water storage is available longer as in the form of snow. If it's warmer and the temperature goes up, the state has to figure out how to capture that water earlier. Because it's not
instead
available.
Instead of releasing it like they do.
And there's even more impact with this rising temperature. It's not even just with the storm of, you know, evaporating water from the reservoirs, you know, reducing stream flows, things like that. We have folks that are studying what's called evaporative demand. It's what the atmosphere, the thirst of the atmosphere, and how much it wants to take the water from the surface. And it's affected by temperature as well as relative humidity and things like that.
Sure, right.
And so this role of temperature is becoming a big thing that we know is coming more than what we can say about precip right now.
I know there's a, and I can't remember where it is, maybe Chris, you might remember or know, there's a reservoir locally in California, Southern California, and they put plastic balls in the reservoir to protect
evaporation.
To stop the evaporation.
Yeah.
I don't know how well that's doing, and has it caught on? Have anybody heard, has it caught on? Or?
No, I don't think so. I think they're still doing that experiment. Like Silverwood, they did a bit. Silver Lake. They did a bit about that. I haven't read much on it recently, success or no success. But they talk about, you know, we were talking about climate change with Chris when was on the phone and saying, you know, is climate change real? Well, we all know that is. As you say, it's part of that, you know, that big Earth ecosystem that we're in. Climate change has been real over millenniums. So the issue really is, you know, who's responsible for it, who's causing it, right? And so, yeah.
Well, you got more people, more machines, more everything here, more hard surfaces, more cemented areas which generate heat, more artificial turf which generates more heat. I mean, so yes, it's going up. But I also think
heat island effect, all those
things. Yeah, but I also think that climate change over decades or hundreds of millions of years, there is a cycle, I believe. Is that true? Mm-hmm. Am I incorrect or right? I don't know. I'm not a meteorologist. I'm asking for help here. Bail me out.
There are certain natural cycles and natural variability. So I think we're still unweaving all the stories of how that's all connected together. And the tricky part with drought is we have drought occurring now, and we need to respond often now and the right decisions and planning in the short term that help us meet these long-term goals as well.
Right.
So it's a tricky place to be, and you're often in response, drought response mode, but you want to think about long-term drought resilience as well. And that's a tricky place with priorities for different organizations that they have to often make a choice.
Yeah. So what does this drought early warning system look like here in California?
I love the acronym. It spells DEWS.
DEWS.
D-E-W-S, DEWS.
For wet.
For
wetness.
Right?
Yeah.
That was good.
Awesome.
Did you pick that up?
No, I did not. That was long before me. So these early warning systems, we want to get to a national one, but we've launched, as I said, these regional ones, and we have 9 so far with full coverage in the continental U.S. at least, and some in the east as well. And so in California, Nevada, we're definitely thinking about how all these pieces and partners work together. And I already mentioned prediction and forecasting is a very important one to some of our key stakeholders. So we work with a lot of these different partners from, like, universities like UC San Diego, private sector, federal, like NASA, Bureau of Reclamation, National Weather Service, tribal, state, like, some of the state agencies, Department of Water Resources. And this starts to be where I come in, where basically the drought warning systems, we do want them to be a robust ground-up network of folks that are working together and identifying, you know, what are the challenges that are in our area the most. And NOAA and NIDAS, basically then, we're more of a coordinating body. We facilitate that collaboration. So we've established these drought early warning systems, but we don't really control or manage them. It's more leveraging resources, partner network. And so it's an interesting place, part of the federal government, because we're implementing activities and research, but we're not the ones that are, you know, instigating the priorities. It really still is the on-the-ground folks. And that's really fun to do because as a regional drought information coordinator, I go to a lot of meetings, hear from a lot of great people and see what's going up and what works.
You give them the intelligent information so they can make an intelligent decision.
Yeah, and often then it means a lot of science translation on my part is sort of in this in-between part, too, of like what forecasts say or what new tools are out there, too. So it's definitely a fun job to try to keep up with it all. And California is massively outpaces some states in producing, you know, new drought research and new drought data and things like that.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really neat. So just I'm just trying to understand in my own mind how broad the drought early warning system is. Is it right now just in California or is it throughout the country?
It's throughout the country. So we had California. So there were a few early ones that were sort of pilot views. California was one of the early ones, but now we're up to 9 systems. So California and Nevada is one. The Pacific Northwest, you know, Washington, Oregon, Idaho is another. The Missouri River Basins is another, for example. the Intermountain West, the Wyoming, all the way down to Arizona, New Mexico. So those are the ones that generally cover the West, and then we have a few other systems in the Southern Plains, a basin in the Southeast, the Carolinas, things like that. And the most recent one we launched was in the Northeast after the Northeast drought a few years ago, and some of the low water resources and issues they were dealing with there. And so we don't have full quite map coverage, and most of the systems having kicked off probably after 2010, they're still definitely iterative and building and thinking about these issues, especially as drought becomes more, it's becoming pretty frequent in some of these regions.
Are you beginning to see any across those regions, any commonalities within, you know, the data that you're finding and the research that you're doing?
Oh, definitely, especially working with the western regions. There's definitely similar things that we're fighting and working on. One of those things being topical here, wildfire, definitely. And so we actually funded some folks to at the Western Regional Climate Center. They're up at the Desert Research Institute in Reno to talk to wildland fire managers and see how are they using drought information, how could they be using it, and identified some key research goals that could help them better use drought information for wildland management and things like that. Because the relationship I've learned more and more is so complex with that between drought and wildfire. And so we have that issue. The Northwest has that issue. I learned today that Hawaii has that issue even, things like that. So there's definitely these cross dues topics that we're honing in on, and one of them is being wildfire.
Oh, so maybe the $64,000 question, right? Dating myself here with that term, right? is asking the question. Well, we've started this. We've got 9 or 10 regions across the country. So, how good is NOAA getting at getting to an early warning system for drought? How good are we at it yet?
That's definitely one of the things we're thinking about, and how do we reflect on that and even, like, assess that is a thing I think we're thinking about right now. It's definitely something we want to do and do correctly and say how we improve things or made changes. There's definitely things like qualitatively we hear, like, oh, someone, you know, made this decision or made that decision based on the information we've provided, but we want to do better than that. So it's definitely something we're thinking as a program as a whole, especially as we move forward going after, you know, being around longer than a decade now, that we want to demonstrate this. And we often have to communicate that to Congress. And so definitely a big thing. And I think we can see that in some of the projects already that we have, that we've checked the box on certain things. But there's always more to do.
What is the top three things that you need to get from Congress to make this thing go to the next level?
Oh, I don't know if I can quite speak to those ones. Those ones are interesting. That's more of the executive director, I think, has some of those comments and works with Congress on, I think.
The answer is money. You have money. As long as you get the money, then you can do whatever you want with it.
True. Yeah. But we're very fortunate to be the program that we have and have a relatively solid funding budget to keep doing the great work and support
right.
The people we're working with. So drought, it crosses the aisle, basically, and with everyone has different, you know, issues with drought, and we try to help all folks.
Right. You know, I look at it as a recipient of this, right, or the man on the street mm-hmm. kind of view, right? So, you know, obviously there's a part of this must be some way to help, you know, the common guy out there just mm-hmm. and gal you know, understand.
Some things like that. So I think there's a lot more data sources out there that are coming out, including social media, that so the regular Joe can sort of give their information about what they see, what they're feeling for drought and what they're seeing, and hopefully hear from others as well through the same mechanism.
Yeah, we don't want to hear about a drought when you go out in the field and you see all these skeletons of dead animals laying around.
Like our carry-on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So how can our listeners better prepare for the drought?
Yeah, so drought.gov, as I mentioned, is one of the biggest resources, one of the first places to go to, I think, whether you're a general public person or anyone in other decision roles. If you're in more of it, if they're in more of like a water agency or someone who does make decisions for a city or agency around that, I would recommend I'm happy to coordinate with me. We do host quarterly calls sort of with those types of users to talk about the information, what the forecast looks like, what are current conditions, some research updates of things we're working on. More broadly, I also host every 2 months a drought climate outlook webinar. Basically, we have a climatologist and forecasters talk about the current forecast, what drought looks like. And we just had our latest one at the end of November, and the next one scheduled for Monday, January 28th. So they can go to the drought.gov and click on the calendar, and they'll find that.
Can anybody listen into that or watch it?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, okay. We use GoToWebinar, and so they're open and able to do it. And then that usually gets you, if you're willing to be on our listserv, so even if you can't make them, we put the recording up on YouTube. We write a two-page summary. So there's multiple ways to get that information, because we find many people like to track throughout the winter how we're doing, and that's why we do them every 2 months, so that folks can be, hey, it was wet in November, we're dry in January, what does that mean going forward? On social media, you can find us at DroughtGov, the Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, also on YouTube. But basically, just come learn about this. I'm happy to talk to folks about it, what we're doing, and how we might provide better information. So I think those are all good sources, I think.
Well, I'll tell you, I sincerely appreciate you coming on the show. You really enlightened me, and I like your passion and your voice, and I know you like I like what you do. That's great. I'm a science guy. I like science stuff, and you know, my thing is, in God we trust, all others bring data. That's the way I work every single day. But no, this was great having. I appreciate sincerely that you made some time to come on our show, and I'm sure this was to me and Chris, we loved it, and I'm sure our audience really enjoyed it. So thanks again on behalf of the Water Zone, Chris and I, and the Toro Company. We do appreciate that.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. All right. Thanks a lot, Chris. And to our listening audience, hope everybody had got some great insight on this and
I'm
more
still
knowledge.
Here. He said, thanks a lot, Chris. I'm still here.
Well, I meant Chris Austin. And you too. You got to change your name. What's your middle name?
Lee.
Okay. I'll call you Chrissy Lee.
No, wait.
No, I won't go there. Anyway, no, I do appreciate it. And great information. What I like about this, I learn a lot, too.
Yeah, me too. I wanted to ask her about the whole climate engine thing. I hear, that's a term that's being thrown around. But
we'll get her back. Yeah, we'll have her come back. Do a speech. Anyway, yep. Thank you very much, everybody, and have a great week. We will not be here next week.